This is Unfortunate History.
What's up, everybody? This is Cody Pennington.
And this is Greg Skinner.
And welcome to Unfortunate History. This is a podcast that covers the wacky, interesting, and unfortunate moments in history. And today's episode will cover the 1953 Iranian coup d'etat.
Iranian coup d'etat.
Yeah, it's weird, right? You'd expect it to be like an Iranian term instead of the French term, but the Iranian coup d'etat.
As usual, fucking clueless. Don't really know anything about this. So I'm intrigued.
Funny enough, not many people knew about this until the CIA declared the documents relating to this coup. They declassified them in, I think it was 2004 or 2003. Mm-hmm. So quite a long time after 1953. So they didn't actually, nobody really actually knew about this until then.
I suppose that's kind of the point of stuff being classified, isn't it? That we don't know about it. And if it's only been released, however many years later, then people probably lost interest.
I don't think they did. You'll see why people probably did not lose interest in this particular subject, because this was a very big thing, especially for the Iranian people. Now, the 1953 Iranian coup was a coup against the Iranian government organized by the UK and the US in an attempt to keep the then royal family of Iran in power. They were trying to overthrow the elected Iranian government. Now, there are disagreements as to the lead cause of the coup, but we'll try to cover most of the assumed reasonings during this episode. We will not be political during this episode. I say that now, but it's probably going to, you know, we might make some references, but we will try our best.
We will definitely make references at some point. Come on, Cody. The listeners know us better than this.
Look, okay. I personally want to try our best to not be political during this particular podcast. Instead, I'd like us to try to tell the facts actually as they are, as a good history podcast should. And I think the listeners will be able to infer whatever they want from these facts, because these are just the facts.
Well, in this podcast, you are the voice of logic and reason, whereas I'm led purely by opinion and emotion, so I cannot make that promise.
You're the Churchill in this situation. I'm the Harry Truman.
I'll take it.
You guys will understand the reference in a moment. Now, let me just make a quick disclaimer in saying that this is a pretty much a hurricane of a story. It is really intense. It's really cool. Don't give up on this podcast at the intro, okay? Stick with us through this story, because it's a very interesting story, especially when trying to understand the history of the Middle East. It's very interesting. So please stick with us to the end. Mm-hmm. Now, firstly, let me acknowledge our sources, because some people have compared us to, quote, Bill and Ted reading from Wikipedia pages.
I like that. I like it. Yeah. I'll take that. Yeah, I know he meant it as an insult, but fuck you. I'll take it as a good thing. I like it.
Well, I asked him which one of us was Keanu. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Matthew. Now,
he's not listening. Come on.
Hopefully we'll convince him to. Now, one of the main sources in this episode, actually the main source, is All the Shah's Men, written by Stephen Kinzer, which you can actually find a link to purchase at on our website, unfortunatehistory.com. There's an affiliate link to the Amazon listing for the book, and if you purchase the book through that link, we get a small percentage of the purchase price. You don't pay anything extra. We just get a little bit extra.
Oh, shit, really?
Yeah, yeah, it helps. It helps you guys. Sorry, Greg, I never told you about this. But
you didn't, mate.
Listeners, it's another way for you guys to help out the podcast. If you're interested in learning more about this story, which I'm sure you will be, definitely pick up All the Shah's Men by Stephen Kinzer. Just go to unfortunatehistory.com, click on the link to the episode, and you'll find the link there to find it on Amazon. I've also pulled some information from articles found on NPR, Al Jazeera, foreignpolicy.com, and the New York Times. So suck it, Matthew.
Yeah, we don't just use Wikipedia. If I'm being totally honest, I don't use anything. I listen to Cody.
Yeah, damn right. And let's just say that if we're getting the story right, the episode is likely to follow the information on a Wikipedia page. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's probably going to be similar to the Wikipedia page. In this day and age, Wikipedia pages are relatively accurate, especially when it comes to historical things. So if we're getting the story right, it probably will seem like we're reading off a Wikipedia page. But you know what? Our personalities are not on Wikipedia pages, you dick. So you should have given this podcast a different chance. I'm going to call, you know what? I'm going to say his last name and get these fans on him and just get them to tear him apart.
No, you know what? All we're doing right now is making people want to give us bad reviews and one stars just to get a reaction out of us. And you know what? That is exactly what will fucking happen.
I really hope it doesn't, because that will sincerely destroy all of the work we've done over this last year. It's been a lot of work, so please don't do that.
We are two incredibly sensitive men. Do not hurt our feelings.
Please. Well, the story of the 1953 Iranian coup begins with the good old British bulldog himself, Winston Churchill. Now, prior to World War I, Churchill noticed something changing in the world. He saw an opportunity in a substance we all know very well today, oil. He saw the future in it being a very important commodity, a commodity which would give the possessor an enormous amount of power. The only issue, it seemed, at this time was that England didn't actually produce any oil, not from its particular country at this moment in history. So Britain would obviously have to look elsewhere.
So wait. So you're telling me that oil wasn't a commodity before this?
It wasn't to the extent that it is today. I think, actually, whale oil was more of a commodity before oil itself. Back when, you know, whale oil ran lanterns and all that, or street lights. That was all ran by, like, animal fats.
Oh, shit, you said whale oil.
Yes.
Oh, no way. So we was using, basically, you know what? Whale stuff is used for quite a lot of stuff, isn't it? We use their vomit for perfume and shit, don't we?
Yes, actually, I think we do. Ambergris is a term for it.
Yeah, don't save the whales. Fuck the whales. They're useful.
No. Save the whales, please.
I'm joking.
Let me just clarify that I wasn't saying we weren't using whale oil right before World War One. I mean, that was quite a long time ago. we had electricity and stuff before World War One. I was saying at this time, oil would be replacing like coal, other forms of.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like I did somewhere in the recesses of my memory and my brain, I knew that, but you caught me off guard there.
They were replacing like the Navy, say like the British Navy would be run with oil as opposed to, I believe it was steam coal type driven warships. So they were trying to upgrade their military, and oil was like a perfect commodity to use for that, as well as being sold to everyone else as an incredibly expensive export.
But still to this day.
Yeah. Well, if you listeners do not know this, which I'm sure most of you do, Iran actually sits on top of one of the greatest seas of oil in the entire world, the ownership of which would give Iran a significant amount of power. And Churchill knew of this great sea of oil and even described it as, quote, a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. So he sent a group of agents to Iran to negotiate the UK receiving a portion of this oil. And this actually culminated in the Iranian negotiators being bribed at the table to accept a deal.
That's interesting. I do know about how the Middle East does sit on a whole lot of oil. I did know that. And I could obviously kind of assume that other superpowers in the world are gonna want to take control of that, because I'm sure the States has its own oil, doesn't it?
It does, and so does England. England drills in the oceans, so
yeah. But we have to go abroad. I'm sure wasn't Texas rich in oil, or am I making that up?
Yeah, Texas is amazingly rich in oil. So is Alaska. There's quite a few places. I mean, after oil had such a big boom, every country started searching for it. That was the point. You know, you had to search for it and find this oil so you could sell it and become global superpowers. Well, this deal between Iran and the UK would give the UK full and total control over Iranian oil. The extraction, the refining, or should I say the extraction, sorry. The extraction, refining, and sale of all of this oil. In fairness, Iran didn't really have the full infrastructure or the wealth at the time to invest in starting up this oil extraction, refining, and selling themselves. There wasn't enough money to invest in that. So having the British come in and assist them with the startup costs would seem like a good deal to an outsider.
Let me guess, it wasn't a good deal.
Well, in exchange for gaining control of the Iranian oil, the UK would give Iran 16% of the profits.
that is shit. Just get a dude with a shovel. He'll get there eventually.
Well, let's put it into context. I mean, 16% of the profits would likely still be a hefty sum in relation to oil sales.
Yeah, but it's not the same as, 100%.
No, it's nowhere near the same as 100%. I mean, you're talking trillions of dollars, probably. You know, you're talking a significant amount of money. Now, the 16% profits could be a hefty sum in relation to oil sales, but the only issue with this is that the profits would only be calculated after the oil company handling the Iranian oil paid a huge amount of tax to the British government. But the company was actually owned by the British government. So the UK was effectively paying itself and lowering Iran's agreed 16% at the same time. And the UK didn't allow Iran to see the books on how the 16% was calculated. They were just handed a check and told to smile, basically.
God. See, we had the potato famine last week where the Brits come off as dickheads. And now already we're dickheads again.
I didn't mean to go with a theme. I'm not trying to down every country, but you have global superpowers. They've all done unfortunate stuff in their past. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you can imagine that this deal would cause a bit of resentment from the Iranian people against the UK. And that resentment kept growing over the years, especially when the Iranians saw how absolutely amazing Britain was doing and their high standards of living when compared to the terrible conditions in Iran at the time. The Iranians were living in some of the worst conditions in the world, even though they had access to one of the wealthiest supplies of oil. Obviously, you can imagine the resentment that would just spring from that uncontrollably.
Yeah, big time. Look, it's literally under your feet.
It's right there. If you're living in a poverty-stricken little city and your hut is on top of billions of dollars of worth of oil, I can imagine you'd be a bit upset that somebody else wants to come and tear down your hut and take it from you, some foreigner.
It's kind of like your bed is just a stack of money, but all you get to do is sleep on it. And then every so often, someone just comes and takes a big chunk of it.
Yeah.
But all you get to do is sleep on it.
Exactly. Well, this resentment led to the rise of a man who is the, I guess you'd call him the protagonist of our story. He was the hero, kind of. This led to the rise of a man named Mohammad Mossadegh.
Mohammad Massive Dick.
Yeah, well, you'll see. Now, Mossadegh was described as an incredibly influential man, especially in 1951. So much so that Time magazine actually chose him as their man of the year for that year. Over the current president, I think it was Harry Truman at this time, over every world leader, everybody, they chose Mohammad Mossadegh as their Time's man of the year, which is pretty impressive. He had been schooled in Europe, and he was the first Iranian ever to receive a doctorate from a European university. I think it was the University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland. That might be pronounced wrong. By the 1950s, he had made his way into Iranian politics. He was known as being incorruptible. He never actually accepted a salary from the Iranian government. Pretty much in all circumstances, he was seen as a very revered figure in Iran. He was seen as somebody who just legitimately wanted nothing but success for the country.
See, that it's sad that I've never heard of him.
Yeah, it is very sad, actually, because he's a very interesting man. You definitely should get this book that I mentioned earlier. Either you, Greg, or both of you. Everybody, grab the book.
Yeah, I'll get it. And then some money comes back to me.
Exactly.
It's like what the British government did with that 50%.
That is a perfect analogy. That is absolutely perfect analogy. Now, Mossadegh was so popular that he decided to run for prime minister of Iran. Now, see, a lot of people are confused by this, but prior to being a theocracy or a more religious-centered government like Iran is today, Iran's government actually had a very democratic feel to it. Hmm. There was a Shah who was the ruler of the country and had the power to basically do whatever he wanted, obviously. But there was also a parliament with democratically elected officials, which included Mossadegh. And the current Shah in the 50s, who we'll mention a little later, was a very mild leader. He wasn't ruling with an iron fist, not very authoritative. Mm-hmm. And because of that, democracy had a bit more room to grow in Iran, which obviously led to more elected officials and a bit more of an opening in the election of a prime minister. Actually, I should clarify, the prime minister was still appointed by the Shah, but to get into government, to make your way to prime minister, you were democratically elected by the people.
Okay.
So he was so popular, they elected him, and then he started campaigning to become prime minister. Hope that makes sense.
it's getting there, for me at least. The listener probably understands a lot more. They had so their Shah was a bit softer, so it gave more wiggle room to democracy. That's what you're getting at.
Yes, exactly. And obviously, I'm trying to draw the difference from today's government in Iran, which is more theocratic. It is ruled more by religion, as opposed to people being chosen by the people to represent them.
Oh, is that the case?
That is the case, yes. We're not going to get into that today. I'll mention it a little bit later, but we won't get into that story. That's a whole nother bag of worms.
Okay.
Now, with, like Greg said, with this kind of opening for more democratic politics, Mossadegh was able to run his campaign for prime minister on two main points. Now, firstly, it was his firm belief that the Shah of Iran should have a more headpiece role to the country, similar to the British royal family and the Queen, which meant that the Iranian parliament should handle the democracy of the country. And secondly, he wanted to nationalize and take back control of Iran's oil fields. He was like, give me that shit back.
Thus, potentially making Iran a first world country today.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You can imagine. It would. Is it today?
No. No.
Not to the extent that you would expect, which is why this story is so important.
Again, look at how Dubai is doing today.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That could have been Iran.
It really actually could have been. That is no exaggeration. Now, from his popularity, Mossadegh was elected prime minister easily. Okay, I'm going to have to qualify this a bit. As I said, the prime minister is appointed by the Shah, but Mossadegh was so popular that there was the Shah had no choice but to appoint him because he was just so popular. If he didn't appoint Mossadegh, then the Iranian people would have revolted. They wanted him to become prime minister.
Okay, I'm going to do my first little political ding, 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 ding about today's politics. Imagine having a world leader today that was so revered by the countrymen, essentially loved, that he'd win by a landslide, just like that, like where people would revolt if they didn't win.
Yeah. Now, he did win the prime minister or premiership, prime minister. He became prime minister, but he actually refused to accept the position before he was able to propose the legislation to begin the nationalization of the oil fields in Iran. And this legislation passed unanimously in the Iranian parliament. So plans began to remove the British company, currently named the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, from the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this upset the UK to no end. Churchill was beside himself that the Iranians would be so rude as to break an international contract. Still, I'm not going to draw parallels to politics today.
All right, let's carry on.
Now, Churchill also saw that the UK would lose an incredible amount of power with the loss of these oil fields. And not only that, but Iran would gain that power. So he kept a reasonable head and decided that the UK should just invade Iran and take the oil back.
What year was this?
1951, I believe this was.
Okay. Let's just invade Iran for oil.
Yeah, let's just do it. In fact, they actually planned at least two plans of invasion, one including warships just blocking the Iranian coast.
So just trade becomes impossible.
Yeah, pretty much. If the Iranians were able to set up their own oil infrastructure, they would have no way of distributing that to the world. And actually, I think they did. My apologies if I'm guessing here, but I think they did actually have a bit of infrastructure for their oil and started exporting it. And the UK did capture some of their vessels containing oil, and they captured it as stolen property.
Basically, the British Navy became pirates.
Kind of, yeah. Depending on how you look at it, obviously.
that, That sounds just like pirating to me. They waited in the water, they captured other ships, and they took their booty.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, yeah. That's the name of the episode. The British were pirates. We'll put that as the tagline. Now, when the U.S. heard about these plans to invade Iraq, they told the U.K., they were like, they could not allow them to invade Iran. They were like, you can't do this. Because, as we'll mention again in a moment, the current president, Harry Truman, was not for that type of thing. He didn't like that type of authoritarian rule over, especially over foreign countries. So Britain decided to take the issue to a Security Council at the UN in New York. And the U.S. also said, you probably shouldn't do that either, because it'll make you look like terrible people in front of the rest of the world. You're basically asking the UN to tell Iran, give us back our oil. And they were like, you should probably not do that. You obviously, the information about this deal you made, the seedy deal you made with Iran, is going to come out. You probably won't get your oil back. You should probably just not do it and continue with negotiations. But the UK went ahead with it anyway.
Fuck them. That's what Churchill said. Then he left the room just flipping everyone off. Mark my words, in 70 years we'll leave Europe.
Well, Mossadegh was actually very happy with this, with the Security Council, because he thought that it would give him a perfect time to represent Iran. So he flew personally to New York to provide the representation for his country. When he arrived in New York, Mossadegh was almost instantly a hit with the American people. He did interviews and other publicity stunts that helped really spread the word of the Iranian troubles. And people were really behind him, even Americans. They were really supportive of him. Mm. And at the Security Council, Mossadegh was so convincing in his arguments that Iran should have control over its own oil that the council found in Iran's favor, making the decision the first defeat for a British resolution at the UN ever up to this point.
God damn.
Which obviously embarrassed the UK further.
And we've not been embarrassed.
No, sir, not when it comes to oil. Now, after the British defeat, Mossadegh was invited to the White House by Harry Truman to try to find common ground with the UK and to negotiate an agreement. However, there was no agreement met, likely due to the fact that Mossadegh just simply wanted his country to own its own property. He just wanted them to have control of the oil. That was it. There was no room for negotiation because he wasn't there to make money or to really further his own careers or what have you. He was there to help his country, and this was the only way he wanted to help his country. And imagine this even today, like to your point earlier. Imagine a politician saying, one of my plans of after I'm elected is to nationalize our oil. And he actually goes and tries to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, my plan is to literally do what is best for my country. Like,
and then he does it, or he at least he does everything in his power to do it. That's a true leader. It really, really is.
And it's kind of what's lacking in the world today.
Yeah, I think actually New Zealand's doing quite well with that.
Okay, well, listen, politically, I'm not that clued up, but I'm going about the main ones that are in the news all the time. No comment on who.
I get that, yeah. But New Zealand's doing very well. I forgot her name, Jocelyn, I think it is. The prime minister, the female prime minister in New Zealand.
They're doing very well, but we don't have a fucking clue who she is.
I can't remember, but she's very, very good. All the stuff she's done is very good. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing pretty much came to an end there, and Iran got its oil back.
Mm-hmm. Really? What? You're good leveling me. I know exactly what's coming. I'm on to you.
Yes.
Cody.
Just kidding. Actually, the UK decided that their final option was to just stage a coup within Iran to overthrow Mossadegh, and ordered their agents in the country to begin preparations for this coup. But Mossadegh actually found out about this and closed the British embassy in Iran, sending all the UK agents back home, including the ones planning the coup, which was pretty nice of him. You'd think,
yeah,
you know what I mean? You'd think if you're planning to overthrow the government, they'd be very violent, but he just sent them home.
Yeah, you get gone. You get disappeared.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what happens today.
Yeah. Now, the only thing left to do for the UK was to appeal to the US. So Churchill approached President Harry Truman and asked him to assist in the coup. But Truman flat out declined. He said that he did not want America to get involved with overthrowing the governments of foreign countries at all. And actually, in a diary entry, he referred to a fear of his of the U.S. becoming a quote, American Gestapo.
Hmm.
This was a huge fear from Truman. So he didn't want to have this kind of influence over foreign countries, which is pretty impressive for an American president.
Yeah, it is.
But as we'll see, this is kind of a turning moment in world history, basically. Well, that was it. The British had completely exhausted all options they could to get their oil back. Except this was all just before the American election of 1952. And this ended with the election of President Dwight D. Eisenhower. And one of the main points of Eisenhower's campaign had actually been that Truman had been much too soft on communism and other threats to U.S. securities abroad, basically seeing Truman as someone with no backbone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this had Churchill jumping for joy. He was foaming at the mouth for this. And the UK was so excited by this election that they couldn't even wait until Eisenhower's inauguration before appealing to the U.S. again. Before he was even made president, Churchill sent agents to America to meet with Eisenhower behind Truman's back again about the coup.
So it's like when you're in school and you're passing notes to your crush, like,
hey, babe.
Hey, do you want to invade Iran? Mm-hmm. yes and no box. Look.
Check yes or no. And like a yes, if no, why? Well, now, this is where the story gets a bit underhanded by the British. The agents that had been sent by the UK knew that they actually had to find a different story to tell the US to convince them to join the coup, because Mossadegh took our oil and we want it back just wouldn't really be persuasive enough.
Yeah, it's not a great argument.
It's not. So the British agents, which are actually quoted in the book All the Shah's Men, they decide to change the story from Mossadegh took our oil and we want it back to Mossadegh is opening up Iran to the possibility of a communist takeover.
Jammy bastards. Yeah, they know how to get a tune out of old Eisenhower.
They sure do. I mean, obviously, the climate in the world at this time, especially in America, was that communists are the devil and we should protect everyone from them. The world at large included. Now, with the newly invented story by the British agents, the incoming CIA director and Secretary of State jumped on the argument headfirst. And 2 months away from Eisenhower's inauguration, 2 months before he was going to be president, the British already had confirmation that the U.S. would be assisting in the coup.
The guy bringing the big guns out.
Yeah, this just blows my mind because it's not just espionage in a foreign country. It's also espionage by the UK in the US.
Yeah.
Changing these stories up. That's crazy. It's like third party espionage.
It's like the UK bought its big older dumb brother to the fight.
Hey.
judging by what you just told me, you got completely just lied to just because of your belief, just because oh, we're just going to use the word communism. That's all it took.
They literally used, they pandered to their ideology against communism.
Yeah, basically.
Now, for their part in this coup, the CIA decided to choose a pretty ridiculous and, wily agent by the name of Kermit Roosevelt Jr. He was actually the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, the previous president.
Hmm.
He snuck into Iran and began putting the CIA plan for the coup in place himself. Mainly, he began bribing people to turn against Mossadegh. But he did this in multiple ways. Literally, that's kind of all he did, was bribe a bunch of people. But he did it in very inventive ways. Firstly, he bribed newspaper editors, columnists, reporters to print lies about Mossadegh.
It's typical control the media, control the masses.
Exactly. He then bribed members of parliament to leave Mossadegh's coalition and denounce him. So you have the papers printing stories about him saying that he's terrible. And then you also have people in parliament denouncing him, saying that he's terrible. Then he also bribed mullahs, which are Islamic priests, so that they would tell people at prayers that Mossadegh was against the Islamic faith. So now you have a three-part pronged approach where he's getting hit by the print by the people he actually works with and by religious leaders, which are, you know, still, even though it wasn't a religious led government at the time, obviously religion still had a huge impact, just like Christianity does, has an impact in American elections.
Yeah, it's religion has an enormous swaying power on who goes where, especially in like in a country like Iran during this time as well. But it's mad that it shows that if you throw money at the problem, 9 out of 10 times it will probably solve it.
It's very true, and it does. It does solve it.
Yeah. Honestly, if someone came at me with a large amount of money and told me to have an opinion, I'd be like, okay, I'll agree with you.
All right. You know, especially if you're in a poverty-stricken country. You know,
that exactly. Even though you're sat on trillions worth of oil.
Yeah.
That you're not allowed to anymore.
Yeah. Well, his bribery didn't actually stop there. Roosevelt also bribed mid-ranking U.S. military officials or U.S. military officers based at the U.S. Embassy in Iran to ensure that they would be ready and willing to join their units to the coup when they were needed. Now, most inventively, he also bribed and recruited several street gang leaders to help sow upheaval in the streets. One of the most famous of the gang leaders was Shaban the Brainless. And he ran a protection racket in the city. Think of a Iranian Ronnie Cray.
You slag!
Now, to Shaban, Roosevelt gave a very specific duty. He was to take several hundred men and have them rampage throughout the city, breaking windows, beating up anyone they saw, shooting into mosques, all the while screaming, "We love Mossadegh. We love communism."
That's so... it's so shit, it's brilliant. Like,
that's not even the most brilliant part. Roosevelt then hired another mob to attack Shaban's mob. And this gave the appearance that the streets were in utter chaos and that Mossadegh had lost total control of the city.
God, again, it's hard to really form an opinion of what's even going on. Like, I'm listening to what you say, but it's just... so the organizing chaos, basically, that's the plan?
That is 100% what's happening. It's all organized chaos, all bred by just money, throwing money at these people and having them go crazy. And it's just causing ripples.
And like I said, the thing is, though, their country would, if they just hung on and stuck with who they had now, they wouldn't need to be bribed. Their country would grow.
Exactly. It's taking advantage of a country in such difficult circumstances.
Literally, yeah, everyone's looking at self-preservation, aren't they?
Yeah, that's all it is.
Again, you can't blame them, especially, again, poverty-stricken country. You got to look after number one, but...
yeah, it's still pretty difficult. Yeah. Now, all the while completing these tasks, Roosevelt was actually sneaking into the royal palace under a blanket in the back seat of a car to recruit the Shah into the coup. I should mention quickly, this is the city of Tehran, so the capital of Iran. Now, the Shah at the time, as I mentioned a bit earlier, was a very meek and indecisive person and was hesitant to really get involved in anything that could see him harmed. However, after multiple meetings, he was brought into the plan. His job was to sign a decree removing Mossadegh from his office of prime minister. However, this was pretty bold because the legality at the time, since democracy had grown in Iran up to this point, was that only the Iranian parliament could remove and approve prime ministers at this point in time.
I was just thinking when you said that, like how the current Shah was like very hesitant to do anything that would see him get harmed. What did they do? Just go in and like... yeah, if you don't do it, we'll punch you. He's like, oh, okay, I'll do it.
They actually brought in, with the meetings, they brought in really high-ranking Iranian officials. So when Roosevelt would go meet them, he would bring in, individually, on each meeting, he would bring in another high-ranking official that said, yeah, I'm in on the plan as well. I'm in on the plan as well. And over time, the Shah realized that there were so many people against Mossadegh that he would be a bit more safe. But... he was still really nervous for the plan. Actually, it's described in the book, All the Shah's Men, that the Shah, whenever he would have these meetings, he would only gesture at the beginning to Roosevelt. He would gesture to him to a table that was in the corner of the room, and he would drag this table to the center of the room, and he would get on top of the table, and they would both sit on chairs on top of the table and whisper to each other because the Shah was so afraid that somebody was recording him speaking in that room, and he was so terrified of being caught out by Mossadegh.
That's paranoia at its finest, I guess.
Well, you can imagine it's very terrible upheaval in Iran at the time, so...
Yeah, I couldn't possibly imagine.
Well, the idea of this decree was to approach Mossadegh with the decree, removing him as prime minister, and he would obviously resist. So when he resisted, they'd arrest him and replace him with somebody more controllable by the CIA. The CIA had actually already chosen Mossadegh's replacement, who was a high-ranking Iranian military official.
His name was John Johnson, and he was a white dude from Seattle. Hi, everyone. I'm going to be your leader now.
Now, this was the plan. However, on the night of August 15th, 1953, the officer chosen to deliver the decree approached Mossadegh's door, but was instantly grabbed by Mossadegh's men hiding in the shadows. And it came to light that the coup had been betrayed. And when hearing about the betrayal, the Shah fled Iran to Rome in a small personal plane. He was actually a pilot himself, and he had a small runway, and he sprinted across the runway into this little little plane and took off and off to Rome.
You're definitely like, fuck this place, I'm out.
Yeah, well, once he found out that Mossadegh knew about the coup, he bolted. And he would only do the plan, actually. That was a prerequisite. He would only do this plan and sign the decree if... at the time of handing Mossadegh the decree, he would be on his runway, ready to jump in his plane if he needed to. The Shah was very paranoid.
Sounds it.
Yeah. Now, since the Shah had signed the order to remove him, Mossadegh assumed that all the danger was really over. The Shah had fled, so there was no one else to worry about, and realistically, the coup had failed.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt was then contacted by the CIA and told to leave Iran as soon as possible before he was caught and killed, basically. However, he decided to stay. He felt that he could actually develop his own plan that could still work in overthrowing Mossadegh, even with the first coup's failure. So he organized 4 more days of rioting and denunciations against Mossadegh, and then struck again 4 days later, I think it was, August 19th, 1953.
Mm-hmm.
4 days after the failed coup. Very, very close in timing. You'd think he'd wait a couple months, but he didn't.
It's like a dude just breaking up with his girlfriend and then getting straight with someone else the next day. Like, no, I'm good. I'll carry on. I know what I'm doing.
This is like the old just get in there and grind type attitude of Americans in the 50s. Now, on this particular day, there were more rioters and military units in the streets, most bribed by Roosevelt, obviously, mm-hmm. but some people were just joining in because they had no idea what else to do. There was just utter chaos in the city. So they just joined in fighting on whatever side they felt they needed to. And all of this came to a head as government buildings were beginning to be attacked. And an enormous battle broke out directly in front of Mossadegh's home, killing 100 people in that battle alone.
Oh, shit. What, are they just civilians or are they soldiers or both?
Both. It's American soldiers, Iranian soldiers, Iranian people, just everybody in the city just fighting each other and dying and killing each other. It's just utter chaos.
See, that's mad to me because I always think of like the 50s as one of the few decades where shit wasn't really going on.
Well, I think that was by design considering the CIA didn't declassify these until the 2000s.
what were the American soldiers who were dying's families been told?
I don't even know if Americans died, to be honest.
I thought you said there was American soldiers.
Yeah, they were there. They were fighting, I think, but I don't know if there was even any deaths on the American side. I'd have to read.
Oh, because their army's so superior and they're all so strong and big.
Well, I mean, there's so much money put into the American military, man. It's like $600 billion a year, I think, is what the amount is. Now, by midnight on August 19th, 1953, Mossadegh's house was in total flames, and he had actually fled the city, and the coup's second attempt succeeded. A few days later, Roosevelt met with the Shah again, who had returned from Rome, obviously, in his own little plane, and the Shah toasted Roosevelt, saying, "I owe my throne to God, my people, my army, and you." And Roosevelt returned to the White House a hero. completely. He had beaten communism, even though there was no communism there at the moment anyway, anywhere to be found.
He had preemptively beat communism, yeah, maybe.
Exactly. He's a kind of hero almost, I'm sure.
He will be in the future, even though Greg Skinner from England will have never heard of you until today.
Yeah, I'd never heard of Roosevelt's grandson till today either. I didn't even know if he had a family line. Well, at the White House, Roosevelt briefed Eisenhower on the events that took place. But Eisenhower actually denies this meeting ever taking place, ever being briefed on what happened in the coup, likely to avoid the repercussions of overthrowing a country's government, I would assume. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't mention it anywhere in his own memoir. But Stephen Kinzer, the writer of All the Shah's Men, claims in his book that he, in fact, pinned a medal on Roosevelt's chest at that meeting. Mm-hmm. So Eisenhower, he's really hiding some stuff there. It's kind of very underhanded, I think. Just own it.
It's not abnormal for presidents to lie, is it?
Suppose not. Now, soon after his return to the U.S., the Secretary of State actually contacted Roosevelt and told him that he did such a great job with the coup in Iran, could he just go down to Guatemala and do the same thing? And
over oil again?
It was over more of a communist government type thing. Actually, let me clarify this. I don't 100% know about Guatemala. This is something that we'll probably cover on another episode. Because Roosevelt denied to go down to Guatemala.
Oh.
But another group was found to do the mission. And less than one year after the elected government of Iran was overthrown, the elected government of Guatemala was overthrown. But this coup had a much worse outcome, I suppose you could say. They're both bad outcomes, but it had a much worse outcome in comparison, because it actually led to hundreds of thousands of deaths in a terrible civil war that lasted over 30 years. So,
was it to Guatemala?
Yeah. It was very, very bad.
Let's save this for an episode then, Jesus.
Yes, we will be. Yeah, we'll be touching on that in another episode. It's a whole other thing. But they just, effectively, the point to make here is that the U.S. government got pretty turned on with the fact that they overthrew the Iranian government, and they wanted to do it again. So they basically were saying to themselves, we can do this to everybody we don't like. Like, we can just do this to anyone.
No one can stop us. And they just started running like, yeah! Yeah.
After the coup, Mossadegh was found and arrested, tried for treason, and convicted. The Shah, who had up to this point been very...
very placid.
He was very, yeah. Did you say placid or flaccid?
I said placid.
I think flaccid is more hilarious.
he's very flaccid.
Yeah. Now, the Shah actually sentenced Mossadegh to 3 years of solitary confinement. And the remainder of his life was to be spent on house arrest. And he lived in his home until his death 10 years later in 1967.
I was expecting a worse fate, if I'm being totally honest. I thought there was going to be something horrible, but...
I think you need to, put into context the difficulty of solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is on the verge of being outlawed in every country. Not every country, but it's on the verge of being outlawed even in America. It's a very, very brutal punishment. And they do solitary confinement for a month, 2 months, not 3 years. That's a significant punishment.
Okay, in all fairness, that I'm taking back what I said there, because I've been on a bit of lockdown with COVID.
Yeah.
And I found myself going insane, and I had TV and PlayStation. I still went to work. I still saw people, and I still found myself going mad because I couldn't go to the pub. So I will retract that statement. It's not that brutal. But I think it's because you don't hear about things being cut off and people being killed that it doesn't sound as horrible to your ears. But then if you think about it, 3 years of solitary confinement.
Yeah, we really desensitized our audience, didn't we? We probably shouldn't have covered all the dirty stuff.
Yeah.
Listeners, don't be desensitized. 3 years in solitary confinement is significant. It's terrible. And he didn't get to leave his house for, the remainder of his life. 10 years. So 13 years of a total sentence. Pretty shit. Well, he lived on a pretty big estate. So I should probably say that. He lived on a pretty big estate in a small town that nobody really goes to nowadays, apparently.
But this is someone who should have been a national hero. Someone who could have literally pulled his country from the ashes, like...
Pulled him, yeah, from being third world, I guess. I don't think it's third world, really. I think at this time it was like second world, I think. But significant power. Significant power. You're looking at like Saudi Arabia or Dubai, like you said. You're looking at places that could really... really have grown as a country, and well, they didn't really get the chance at them, or at least not yet, I suppose. Now the Shah tried to reappoint, I guess, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company back into controlling Iran's oil, but the country had been so affected by Mossadegh that the choice would have seen an uprising, which, as I alluded to earlier, would come later anyways. But either way, the decision couldn't go ahead. So instead, ownership of the oil was split between multiple oil companies, including Exxon, Texaco, and other well-known oil companies, like ones that you would probably know today. Anglo-Persian Oil Company was given 40% ownership of the oil and later rebranded itself to British Petroleum, or good old BP.
I saw that coming. I really did. I saw it coming.
The boogeyman.
BP drilling those fucking holes and killing the planet.
Yeah, there you go. Or like South Park, going to be drilling holes on the moon soon. Yeah.
We're sorry.
Well, the coup actually had an enormous ripple effect that has led to the CIA being a player in the overthrowing and destabilizing of foreign governments, like we saw with Guatemala. Pretty much exactly what Harry Truman was afraid of. The exact thing. Now, the Shah being back in full power and exercising that full power blocked all forms of democratic sentimentality. So democracy effectively died in Iran, which... could be directly connected to the rise of fanatical Islamic fundamentalists that we see today. Now, obviously, you can never draw a direct line from cause and effect with moments in history. It's near impossible. But it's very hard to ignore what the loss of democracy really did to Iran and its people. And if we're looking at Islamic extremists, pretty much the world.
Oh, big time.
Now, as I said at the beginning of this podcast, we will not get political. We tried, at least. But it's worth drawing a few parallels to today's world, at the very least, a little bit. For instance, Great Britain chose to leave the EU. We're not going to decide whether or not this is good or bad. But Great Britain chose to leave the EU to gain control over itself again. Is that not what Iran also sought to do in this story?
Yeah, essentially, yeah, it is.
Could you imagine if Mexico owned all of the oil in Texas? Do you think Americans would be able to even accept that for a single day?
Not even remotely. People would draw arms.
Exactly. And Churchill, he wanted to better England, but he wanted to do so at the detriment of Iran. He didn't really care. And I think we'll be discussing quite a bit more of Churchill's imperialistic views on future episodes, but... he was basically pushing for imperialism, controlling the UK, controlling vast parts of the world, like the good old days.
But that's the thing. I feel like that's a mentality with people today. Like I see it quite a lot. Like if you're from another country, it's like you're from another species of some sorts. It's small minded, really. Like there's not a lot of unity in the world. If I'm being totally honest,
no, there really isn't. And Churchill did, in the end, fail in his quest for imperialism. But it could arguably be said that the situation really hurt Iran much more than it could ever hurt the UK. And that, I think, is truly unfortunate.
That is truly unfortunate. And in the grand scheme of things, the UK is doing, you know, okay.
Yeah, the loss of the oil... I mean, yeah, it affected it a little bit, but in the long run, the UK is great. So, I mean, it's pretty sad to see. We would go into more details about what happened to Iran later on, the 1979 overthrowing of the government again, and all this other stuff. But that has to be saved for a future episode because we need topics. So
all right,
yeah. I think now we'll just head on into some housekeeping.
That's good. I was about to say a little segue. Much like the oil reserves, history is finite and we need topics.
Yeah.
Was that good or was that shit? I felt like that was kind of I felt like that was better in my head than it actually was.
Clever. Clever. Guys, okay, I have a couple things I want to say real quick. Firstly, we made a couple of references earlier to to the man named Matthew. He mentioned something along, he gave us a review. It was a lighthearted one-star review, but it was a criticism that we were actually able to fix. In it, he said that we read directly from Wikipedia pages. That's unbelievably untrue. I do much more research than I think he would understand, really. I do a lot more research to compile all this information into one single document, and I make myself a script for each show. So I couldn't be reading from a Wikipedia page because I don't copy and paste it, obviously, from Wikipedia. I put it all together. But to that effect, I have now decided to put all of the sources on our website. So you can actually go to unfortunatehistory.com, click on the episode pages, and you can read my outlines and stuff for the show, but also you can see all of the sources that we link to. And we mentioned it earlier, we will have links for all of the sourced books that we'll be using for all of the episodes, because we normally either use a book, documentary, or some sort of thing like that. And we'll link those as well. So if you want to hear more about the stories, you can support the show that way by going to our website and clicking our affiliate links and buying the books that way. And we get a small bit of money from that. I mean, it doesn't come from the authors and it doesn't come from you. It comes from Amazon, which is good. Take more money from them. But that really helps us out. It's a whole nother way for you to support our show. Yes, we have the merch store, which is back up now. But really, we don't have that much money from merch. That's normally just to spread the word of the show, actually, to be honest. We don't even charge VAT on EU products. So, and that really means that we pretty much break even on all orders. So if you want to support us, please start going to unfortunatehistory.com. It'll really help us out. And if I know some people bought books on some of the topics we covered, I've spoken to people that have. That's been fantastic. And if you want to do that, you can do it through our website now, which I think would be great because it helps you guys learn a bit more for something you're interested in. And it helps us get a little bit back for the show. Basically, I'm trying to keep this show free and hopefully, I mean, in the long run, it'd be nice if it was completely ad-free. As well, to keep it as free as possible. But if it gets to that point, we might have to introduce ads. But I don't want to charge you guys to listen to the show.
No. And also, if you do buy merch, tag yourself in it. Tag us in you wearing it or with a cup of coffee on it, because I'd love to see it personally.
Shout out to Erica. She's done that. She did an awesome little photo op with her with her shirt and socks. That was really cool. They both, her and her fiance were wearing shirts and socks while they were listening to our podcast, which is fantastic. That's so cool, man. Like, thank you guys so much. I also want to just give huge shout outs to everybody that's been in touch. We had people get in touch for random reasons, whether the website was down or whether the show wasn't streaming on a certain, certain site, or just to say that they have a request for a topic and to say that we're doing a good job. That's amazing, man. That's so cool. It's been so awesome to hear from everybody. I've loved every second of that. It gets me so excited to hear from fans and to speak to, fans and stuff, or listeners. Yeah. I won't call you fans yet. You know, you may be like, oh, you guys are all right. You're no last podcast. So
yeah, well, I got a message personally off a guy called Kenneth saying how good we were doing and hope it keeps going. So thanks, Kenneth, man.
I heard from Kenneth as well. Thanks, Kenneth. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. We'll get you a discount code for the merch store. So, boom.
Big up.
Yeah, buddy. Like a $2 off. Something like that. Yeah. I suppose that's kind of all I wanted to say. I really want to push the stress that if everybody could go to the website, that would be great. That's the best place to find the information for the show, especially if you want to listen to the episode. You can listen to all the episodes right on our website. You can go straight to our website, press play, and close your phone, and they still work. It's just like listening through a podcast app. You just, you're stuck in unfortunate history land.
Also, I've got to give a shout out to Sam for covering me on the last episode as well. Did a great job.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sam. I appreciate you stepping in.
My Instagram handle was Lumper Lover for a while.
Yeah, have you changed it again? There's no way to keep track of this.
No one follows me anyway. You're the brains behind this. I'm just here to talk a little bit.
Barely anyone follows me as well. I think I hope people follow the show. I think the show is what people come back for. Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for your support. I can't stress it enough. Thank you. It's been a really good couple of weeks. I felt really supported in the last couple of weeks. Like I said, the every other week schedule is temporary. We will move back to a weekly schedule. Other than that, I think it's good to close it out now. Unfortunately, I think we have to go.
Yeah, man.
So, stay unfortunate, everybody.
Stay unfortunate, guys. Ta-ra.
Bye.